You think you can get in there and find out what's going on?
I can try. Where are you going?
See if I can get in the way.
Everyone to the XCast, the truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host as ever, and in this episode we are talking about the 22nd episode of the second season of the X-Files, F Emasculata. And I'm really delighted to have back, after an appearance last year when we interviewed him about all his X-Files related works and his books and everything like that, it's really nice to have John Kenneth Muir back. Hello, John.
Hello, Tony. Thank you for having me back. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Well, the pleasure is mine. You are someone who's written so many great, you know, breakdowns and books about the X-Files and Millennium and Chris Carter's universes. It's like getting an X-Files scholar on the show when you're here.
Well, thank you. And right back at you. So I know this is going to be a great time.
Oh, you're too kind. You're too kind. Before we briefly have a little chat, I'm just going to remind everyone where you can find us on social media in case you want to help us extend the conversation about F Emasculata and the X-Files and everything in between. You can find us at the X_cast on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook if you just type in the X-Cast for our page, and the X-Cast podcast fan group if you want to really get involved. The group is growing. We've got over 200 members. We have lots of chat pretty much every day about the X-Files, and it's really great to dig deep into the show even more. So catch us over there for even more extended conversation. John, what have you been up to since we last spoke? I think it was October last year. So you've been busy, haven't you?
I have. I've been very busy. I've been I became a full-time communication instructor. I'm teaching film and introduction to communications and intercultural communications and things like that. So I've been getting I pulled back a little bit on my writing till I knew I could deliver at the teaching, but having a great time.
That's awesome. Where do you teach that then?
I teach at a school in Monroe, North Carolina. It's South Piedmont Community College, and I just love it. I love my coworkers, and I love the students, and I love that I get to bring in film to talk about film. And I also, as far as communication, I get to talk about things like the Sapir-Whorf theory and movies like Arrival. And, you know, I'm always trying to bring in that kind of thing.
Your students must love it. I think I'd love doing those classes.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I really enjoy it. I love being in the front of a classroom.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. What about any writing works you're going to be doing then, if you're going to be getting back on it relatively soon? Have you got anything in the pipeline there?
Yes. I did not finish what I had hoped to last summer, and I'm hoping in my interim between semesters here, I'll be able to finish the found footage horror film companion I'm working on. I really want to get that done. I'm also working on, I have an essay coming up in a Battlestar Galactica anthology that's down the pipeline a little bit. So I have some projects going on.
That's great. I remember you talking about the found footage book, actually, when we spoke last. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah.
It's so horrible that I tell you what, I have not gotten done with it. I feel so terrible. It's just kind of sat there for, you know, since October, but I'm committing to finishing it this summer. Oh, so
good things come to those who wait, John, I'm sure. I'm confident in that. Definitely. Well, that's amazing. That's brilliant. We're looking forward to those things, and we'll definitely promote them on the X-Cast and everything like that when they come out. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Right then, let's talk about the episode in question. Let's discuss F Emasculata. F Emasculata is the 22nd episode of the second season of The X-Files. It first aired on April 28th, 1995. It was written by Chris Carter and Howard Gordon and directed by Rob Bowman. After several prisoners die of a very mysterious contagion, Scully attempts to discover the epidemic cause while Mulder hunts two escaped fugitives who may be carrying this deadly disease.
I'm sorry, this is a restricted area.
Who are you?
Dr. Osborne.
Are you the prison doctor?
No.
Who do you work for?
The CDC.
You work for the Centers for Disease Control? What are you doing here? Sir? I'm a medical doctor. I want to know what's going on here. Sir, if you don't let me in, a lot of people in Washington are going to find out that you're conducting a secret quarantine in here.
I'm under strict orders.
So am I.
All I can tell you is that there is a flu-like illness spreading among some of the prisoners.
How many people are infected?
14 men so far.
Any deaths?
10 of the 14.
What are the chances of men who escaped are infected?
So out of 10, John, what would you give F. Emasculata?
Well, I'm going to just say right off the bat that I absolutely give this episode a 10 out of 10. And the reason why is, you know, I look for two things. First, is it effective? And for an X-Files, for me, that is you know, is it frightening? Is it scary? And every time I see those pustules, those boils erupting into people's faces, it's terrifying. It's a terrifying episode. And the second criteria is, does it reflect, this is for me, the culture and the times from which it was created? And clearly it does.
Absolutely. It feels a bit like the preamble to a lot more of the conspiracy stories we get in the show as the show goes along, and that they're really sort of finding their feet with being able to balance an exciting action story and thriller with these real sort of murky, dark conspiratorial waters. And, you know, they've done conspiracy stuff before, obviously, in the show up to this point, but this feels like them really starting to get a handle on balancing those.
Absolutely. And here we get a piece that becomes important later, although it's not the same pharmaceutical company that is involved later, which has like Roush Chemicals. Is that it? But this is Pink Pharmaceuticals. So here we're getting like the corporation big business piece of the conspiracy, which is interesting to me.
Yeah, in my headcanon, they are all sort of connected. In fact, there is one element to the episode which we'll get to later that I think is a good, apart from the smoking man being around, I think is a good sort of example of how this could connect to the syndicate and the larger conspiracy. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Okay, I have an idea too. Well, maybe we're on the same wavelength.
We probably are. But originally, with this episode, they were unsure whether to release it so close to the movie Outbreak. I don't know if you remember the movie Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman, which had a really good, you know, stellar cast. It was one of the big movies in 1995, and I think they were worried that people might just think this is like a really cheap TV knockoff of Outbreak. But I mean, I think it's a different kind of film to Outbreak. Ultimately, a different kind of episode, I should say, a piece of television. So I don't think they had much to worry about there, really. It was just virus, you know, virus fever, I think, in the air.
Absolutely. I mean, I think virus fever, yeah, that's exactly what it is, right? Hemorrhagic fever, yeah. That's what it was. There was, you know, as far as historical context, you look around this time, you know, say 1994 maybe to 1997, you know, you had the release of the best-selling book, The Hot Zone, by I think it was Richard Preston. And then you had, of course, Outbreak. And after F. Emasculata, we had a TV series, The Burning Zone, again, back to The Hot Zone, which was about sort of this team of scientists fighting conspiracies and viruses every week, which was kind of an X-Files knockoff. But, you know, it was clear that there was something going on in the culture regarding people's fears of an outbreak, of an epidemic. And I think it was American scientists that said, you know, they counted The Hot Zone as sort of one of the most important or influential books for science of the 20th century. It was like in the top 100 books. So, I mean, the impact of that was incredible. And of course, what that book was about, one of the things it was about, was tracking an outbreak of Ebola, I guess it was the Reston virus, in Reston, Virginia. And of course, this X-Files is set in what, Dinwiddie County, Virginia? So it's like, wow, as usual with the X-Files, it's like, it's so close to reality that it's very plausible. It's not, you know, it's not fantasy. It's, you know, for what happened in Reston, Virginia, it was Hazleton Laboratories. They had that they like would give, you know, they would sell lab animals for testing, I guess. And They had brought in from the Philippines these, if I can say this word right, macaque monkeys, long-tailed monkeys, and they were carrying this virus, which fortunately turned out to be non-pathogenic for human beings. But, you know, a third of the monkeys died. This was, you know, not far from the capital of the United States. The CDC was involved. You know, these monkeys had come in through, they'd been imported through New York, Texas, you know, Mexico City. They'd been all over the place. And then they were found to be infected with what looked like Ebola. You know, so the location of this X-Files, you know, setting it in Virginia, I don't think that's any coincidence, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. They were tapping into these real life things, as I'm sure Outbreak was. I mean, I'm sure Outbreak, the movie, was inspired or came off the back of the Hot Zone. I think the Hot Zone was sold, and then they made Outbreak. So yeah, it was very much in the air, to use a pun, right. In the air. I'm not doing this intentionally, you know, the virus thing. So yeah, it was a good time to tap into all the fears about Ebola and things like that. And, you know, I think those, even though Ebola has become less of a fear, you know, even a few years ago, there was a kind of resurgence of that. And there've been these viruses that are still cropping up, and they've caused quite a lot of, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, that are still causing, you know, problems and are still causing outbreaks and infections. So even now, 20 years on, there is still that underlying fear that a virus we can't cope with could still get out there and destroy us, really.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I love about the X-Files. I don't know what it is or you know, what kind of, you know, magical alchemy this is that Chris Carter and his team, you know, they're often able to do, but they were able to sort of create these stories that seemed very vital and important in the 90s, but yet also, you know, looking back at this vantage point, like, wow, it also still seems ahead of its time. I mean, that, you know, that it's still dealing with these things. And, you know, we've dealt with, you know, avian flu and, you know, SARS and, you know, all this stuff. And like you said, Ebola made this resurgence, golly, what was it, 2 years ago?
Something like that.
You know, you had politicians in our country freaking out, saying it could, you know, if somebody was infected, you could catch it from a public toilet seat, which of course is not true. our current president at the time was tweeting, you know, shut down the airports, all this kind of stuff. And look, you know, and here's the X-Files talking about it back then in that era. And you could, so, you know, we could watch it then as part of that Hot Zone context and see it now and see, well, you know, this is still something that's, you know, vibrant or important in the culture. It's still something we see as a possibility.
Indeed, absolutely. It's still there. It's still hovering around. And I think they based it, as you say, on these specific, you know, realities. And one of the things they knew about was that pharmaceutical companies do send scientists across the world looking for plants or animals that have medicinal use, which is what Torrance is doing at the beginning. And they took it off the back of that, off the back of the Hot Zone, and created this real concoction. I mean, I would give this a solid 9. I think this is a great episode. This has always been one of my favorite X-Files, and I've watched this one a lot.
You know,
replay value. Yeah, it's got some amazing replay value, this episode. It's just got, it moves like a bullet. It's got all of these components to it that are really interesting. It's got Mulder and Scully, I think, doing what they do best. They really are. Even if they're not together for the majority of the episode, this episode really taps into what they're good at, which is Mulder out there trying to find the source or the cause or expose the conspiracy, and Scully in the lab trying to figure out the scientific basis and the underpinning element to it. And this does that so well throughout the entire episode.
Absolutely. And I was, you know, pleasantly surprised watching it again, you know, in preparation for this, to see how strong Scully is. Again, you know, it's easy to forget, you know, 20 years ago, you know, to watch the authority with which she deals with these people who are trying to keep her out and keep her in the dark, and how she just sort of, I don't want to say forces, but she's going in there to figure out what's going on. And I love that determination and strength in her character, and that we were seeing that in the 1990s when that wasn't always the case for female characters on television. And of course, there's almost a horrifying repercussion for her and her strength in this episode, because she goes down to the incineration room and there are all these corpses in bags, and she is in such a sort of you know, rush to find out what's going on and collect a sample. She gets down very close to one of these impacted bodies, contaminated bodies. And one of those boils, if the doctor played by Charles Martin Smith didn't sort of get in front of her, it would have hit her. Every time I see that, I'm having sort of a near freak out watching that. You know, she doesn't have on a mask. She doesn't have on gloves. I don't think. And you know, she definitely doesn't have a mask on at that point. And you know, she's down there right with all the contaminated bodies, and she almost gets hit with the spores.
Yeah, I thought that. I did think. I made a note that said she if she's lucky she didn't get hit by that
exactly.
Spores. She really was
right. And they had a test, you know, with the box and the bug on her skin to make sure that she wasn't contaminated. But boy, she almost got the brunt of that there. You know, it's a scary thing to look at.
Yeah, but it just shows how brave she is in, as a character. And I think one of the things that's come up as we've been doing this podcast is talking about Scully's development as a character. And, you know, in season two, she's become much, much of a stronger character than even she was in the first season. And one of the things about that is that she's starting even more. Gillian Anderson has really figured out this character completely, and they're starting to write Scully in much more of a way where she has real agency throughout the entire episode. And in this, she really does. She really just takes command of this, and there's various points where she's calling Mulder up and saying, "You need to do this. You need to do this."
Right.
and that's brilliant, because it's quite often the other way around.
And it's so great because she's not doing it in any other way than because of her knowledge and competence. You know, her role is written and she performs it so beautifully. You just understand what's at stake and how she's like facilitating the solving of this crisis.
It's done really, really well. I mean, overall, it's just a really, really good episode. I would say it's one of season two's strongest episodes. IMDb has an overall rating of 8.2 out of 10 for this episode, which puts it in the higher tier of the episodes over the season. It's not among the top, actually, and there are quite a lot of episodes which do top it out by one or two point marks. But it is up there, and I think it deserves to be slightly higher. You know, these are all aggregated. This is out of 2,289, you know, ratings. But even so, it deserves, I think, its place high up on the list of season two.
I think so too, and I also think that it's probably one of those episodes that you can almost, I don't want to say forget, but when you're accumulating, you know, best of season lists or best of series lists, it's one you sort of don't automatically think of. I'm not sure exactly why, but, you know, you know, when I think of season two, I think, oh my gosh, you know, Colony and Endgame. And I think, I think Irresistible or whatever, you know, you think of sort of these almost immediately, these sort of high concept, high impact stories. And this one doesn't immediately come to mind. But then whenever I remember this episode, like, I love this episode. This should be, you know, this is a top tier episode. You know, it should be listed near the top of, you know, every list for this season. So
I think maybe it's because it doesn't show off. It just gets the job done. It's one of those episodes that it's not super mega budget like Colony and Endgame with all these amazing big sets and big set pieces. It's not got that level of, you know, incident that something like One Breath or Dwayne Barry has and things like that. And it's not got an iconic monster like Irresistible with Donny Faster and things. It hasn't got those elements that immediately, like, say, Tombs in season one, where everyone goes, oh, everyone remembers Tombs. It doesn't have that.
Right. Oh, yeah, I that's a good explanation. I think you're right. It's like it's a great X-Files episode, but it's not specifically about the overarching conspiracy, and it's not specifically about a monster that we consider, you know, sort of in a two-dimensional fashion, a monster, although I guess a virus is a monster, you know, but it doesn't, you're right. I think it doesn't draw us to say, oh, it's clearly this or it's clearly that. And so for some reason, it sort of falls between the cracks of those two descriptions, those two, you know, it's not strictly myth arc, not strictly monster of the week either.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mix of everything, this one. So it's going to be an interesting one to discuss. So let's go deeper and talk in more detail about F. Emasculata. So the episode begins in the jungles of Costa Rica with a doctor named Robert Torrance, who is investigating, as said before, plants and animals. And, you know, he's an entomologist, and he comes across a boar carcass, which is being pecked at by birds, which is covered in pustules. These really dark, horrible pustules. It's a really creepy moment with like bugs running across the carcass, and they really bring it to life really well visually. And it's just a bit gross out. One thing I think straight away that strikes me about this episode, and it's all the way through, I don't know about you, I think Mark Snow's score is phenomenally good throughout this entire episode.
Absolutely.
It's right from the very, very, very first shot, right from the first second, it has this dun, 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 this doom all the way through. And it never lets up throughout the entire episode.
It's sort of relentless, and the episode is itself relentless. And you know, the pace of it is part of how effective it is, I think.
And the music really complements it in a way that, I mean, he did some amazing individual episode scores, Mark Snow, which is being borne out by all the volume sets he's bringing out of the compilations of music. You know, so many episodes have their own sense of theme with the music in the X-Files, but this one has always really stood out to me because it does sweep you along with the story. Mm-hmm. And it puts you on edge right from the very start, which is what the whole episode is trying to do. You're absolutely right. And, you know, and even the visuals, you know, with like a dark bird of prey just pecking away, and it's straight away, it's just full of, there is that immediate sense of foreboding throughout this entire episode in this teaser.
Also, I mean, it's just disgust.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, the pustule explodes on him and he's radioing in, he's dying, he's got the pustules all over him. I think Rob Bowman's direction as well is really good. There's that scene where Torrance is sitting there and he's radioing, and you've got, The jungle is dark, but there's this light on him, and it's especially on Blu-ray, it looks so good. And every time Rob Bowman, we've talked about this in the podcast as well, especially this season, every time Rob Bowman directs an episode, you can tell because he's got that extra sheen to what he does.
It just strikes me watching these episodes and thinking about what TV looked like in the 90s, again, how cinematic the X-Files is, and you know, that why that's a reason to go back to it and watch it and enjoy it. And this episode certainly feels that way. The choice of angles, the whole mise-en-scene, it's just incredibly cinematic.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. For the pustules, since we're talking about them, they also had quite a complex system of how they burst. They constructed a handheld device that connected via tube to the saws that had been set up, and then they would, when the device was pressed, the pustule would burst. So that's how they did that effect on the boar carcass, and then later on all the bodies.
Oh man.
Yeah. So I'll drop that in there for you, John. Nice little bit of creepy info.
Yes, it's good to know. I figure they had to do, you know, something like with bladders or something where they're you know, the throbbing and then the explosion. It's just so disgusting. And I remember seeing this on its first airing, and my wife was practically having a fit at the finale when his face was next to the little boy and the convict's face, and it looked like it was going to explode on him. You know, that is just, you know, horrendous, right? Yeah.
Well, apparently Frank Spotnitz said that when we saw the pustule bursting on film, he said, we just laughed because it was just so over-the-top grotesque.
which
you can understand, can't you? I mean, it doesn't take anything away from how scary and creepy the episode is, but at the same time, it's just like, oh!
If you have any problems, fears, pathology about germs or sickness or, you know, contamination, I mean, this episode just totally, you know, picks at that, you know, it just totally goes after that.
I think the only other piece of entertainment that has made me feel that way, have you ever seen the Steven Soderbergh film Contagion?
Oh, yes.
That
yes.
film scared me to death. I remember coming out of the film saying, I've got to wash my hands straight away. I was terrified of everything after that film.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and then my going back to my wife, she didn't want to watch that for like two. I didn't see it till 2 years after it came back out. She's like, I'm not seeing that. I'm not going to the theater to see that. That's just going to gross me out. But yeah, and it did, right? It was very upsetting.
I don't blame her. Part of me wishes I'd never seen it. But obviously then they find Torrance dead and we're out of the teaser. But when we come back, this episode, I think, maybe more than any other X-File, takes a long time to get Mulder and Scully into the story. There are quite a few scenes in the prison setting up the other Robert Torrance getting the piece of, you know, carcass or whatever with the pustules on, and then introducing the prisoners who escape. I don't know about you, I just thought, wow, this is like taking its time to set up the pieces of the story before logically Mulder and Scully get in there.
Right, and I thought it was interesting and also discomforting that we don't get, at this point, any of their sort of office banter. You know, we're in Mulder's office. We don't get any of the signposts sort of like the X-Files as a comfortable TV series where they're in their basement office together and, you know, they're going to tell us what their assignment is or anything like that. I mean, like the first we see of them, they're like walking downstairs, I think, into the prison. So already the episode is sort of taking away any sense of comfort or familiarity, like with what's going on. The first time we see them, they're sort of arriving and everything is already in motion already. We're not getting any explanation of what has occurred. They're just like, we're just being thrown into it like they are.
Exactly, being thrown into it, which is exactly what happens to them because they don't even know why they're here. You know, they're not quite sure why they've got this assignment, which is one of the things that they say straight away, that the case just came out of Skinner's office and they're not quite sure why they're here, which is unusual in itself. Like you say, Mulder's normally giving Scully a briefing saying, it's this, it could be that vampire from the 13th century, it could be whatever. But in this, it's a case they're not quite sure.
Emotionally, psychologically, I look forward into the X-Files like, okay, we're going to see that, you know, we get the teaser where something horrible happens and we're introduced to some horrible, bizarre thing. Then we get our theme music, which we love, and we're totally in the mood. And then we get Mulder and Scully in the office and, you know, Mulder's doing a slideshow or whatever, you know, of the crime scene. And Scully is like, oh, you know, that's not what this is. You know, they'll bicker about what they think they're seeing, you know, and then they go. And, you know, here it's like, no, you're not going to get any of that. We don't know. You know, we don't know why we're here. We don't know what exactly happened. You don't know where these orders came from. We're denied the comfort of our routine. And I think that's very interesting.
It is good. It is good. And it is quite a brave choice. Straight away, we meet Dean Norris's U.S. Marshal. And Dean Norris is always great. Dean Norris, obviously, of Breaking Bad and later Under the Dome, though we don't talk about that. it's probably best not to. Although he's good in that. Yeah, that's a ridiculously bad show, but he's always good in it. He's always good fun. He's just one of those actors who just commands a scene, I think, Dean Norris. He's great.
Right. And no nonsense, you know. He's sort of intimidating. It's like, yeah, I wouldn't want to walk into him. And he's like, so have you ever run an escaped convict operation? And I was like, no.
He's like, no. Right. He's like, right, well, stay out of my way then.
Exactly. I mean, that's it. Well, let someone who has, you know, take charge. You just stay out of my way. Exactly. It's like, wow, okay.
He's got real swagger about him in throughout this episode. Although I think there's a few like nice subtleties in the writing with this episode. I think one of the subtleties is that, and it's not really ever spoken in dialogue, but I think it comes out of the performances of David Duchovny and Dean Norris. But steadily, I think the Marshal gains more respect for Mulder as the episode goes on, as he's with them, and as they're getting into this case, and the Marshal starts to realize there's more to it than just some convicts escaping. I just think that's layered in quite well.
Right, and you start to see that at the, I don't know if it was the rest stop and the telephone booth, and Mulder says, the convict probably made a call to his girlfriend, did you check, you know, and he goes to do it, and he sort of maybe gains his grudging respect at that point, you know, definitely. I think there's a little arc there, sure.
Yeah. And I like that, because this episode does those things not necessarily in your face. It has things running through that are really good. You know, I mean, one of the things that happens there, and obviously as the convicts are getting out and one of them's really infected and, you know, he's not well, and they jack that that car, you know, that trailer car with that family. You know, they kill the dad. They murder him in this bathroom, and he's left dead, and you see him, he's just bleeding out from his head and he's dead, with his young family just there upset. And you know, you think, well, there's that layer of cruelty in them, in those prisoners, that,
right,
you know, that isn't made a big deal of, because it's more about the chase, about the virus. But there is that level of, you know, they didn't have to kill that guy. They could have just knocked him unconscious, stole his truck, you know, but they don't. They murder him. And I think little beats like that add to character quite well.
I think so too. And I think it also adds to sort of, I don't want to say the cutthroat or brutal, but I mean, there's an aspect of this episode that's just very direct. I mean, something terrible could really happen. And it's like, it's so terrible that even you know, this mourning, weeping family who's just lost this man. It's like, we're not even going to stop and really linger on that. You're going to see that they're mourning, and you're going to see that the father got killed, but we can't even really stop and acknowledge your feelings on this because of what's at stake. Again, it sort of plays into this sort of relentless thing. You know, we're not allowed any moment to be like, oh my gosh, that poor family. I mean, we think it, but boy, we're moving on, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that is the, like you say, directness, I think is the perfect word for it. And it just sweeps you along. It just keeps going. At this point, obviously Mulder and Scully, they were split up, and Scully meets Dr. Osborne, played by Charles Martin Smith, who's a relatively, you know, recognizable face, actually, Charles Martin Smith. He's one of those people who's cropped up in a fair few things. I always remember him getting blown up at the start of Deep Impact.
Oh, my God.
Which is a random callback.
I remember he was in Starman, going way back, I believe. And he was in a movie about wolves that I loved when I was a kid, way back in the 80s, where he was a scientist who was, like, spending some time, like, living with wolves. And I wish I could remember what that movie was called.
I think it was called Never Cry Wolf.
Never Cry Wolf, was that it? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you know, he's to me like somebody like I instantly recognize and say, oh, wow, yeah, good supporting actor, you know?
Yeah, I think he's probably most well-known for appearing in The Untouchables as one of the main crew in that, isn't he?
Yes, that's right, he's the accountant, right?
Yeah.
Brian De Palma, yeah. Brian De Palma's the Untouchables, yeah, there.
Yeah, exactly. He's one of those. And so you look at him, like you say, and you go, oh, it's that guy.
Right.
That guy. And The X-Files does that every now and then. It crops up, you know, it puts people. I think the next one, I think Softlight has Tony Shalhoub, who's one of those actors who you go, oh, it's that guy. He's very good in this as the scientist who is involved in the cover-up, but he's got his own sort of personal demons with it. He doesn't really want to be doing this, you know. He's a man who's got some level of, you know, compassion and morality, but he's swept right up in this all the way through. That's, and you see that through his relationship with Scully.
I think he's got a moral compass. He's involved in something that it's not good to be involved with, but he clearly has some moral compass and knows that some line has been crossed here as far as you know, the danger to the public or what have you, something like that. And you know, and of course, it's just terrible what happens to him. And again, it's the way they stage the scene where he's infected and Scully is right there. I mean, it could have so easily been reversed. And it just strikes me, you know, sort of the randomness of, like, infection. It's, you know, somebody gets sick and somebody doesn't, and they're standing right next to each other. You know, it's, again, it's just some aspects of that, like, the random danger of this, and that it could have been Scully for sure.
And what I like, I think, is that, I mean, obviously, you know, we know Scully's going to be okay because she's one of the leads, but at least they acknowledge the fact that she could have been infected. You know, they could have just ignored that. They could have just had her try, you know, investigating the cover up and that this pustule exploded right by her face, but they don't. They do eventually go, he does say to her, well, you know, you were there, you could have had one land on you, and then you have to go through the, you know, that fear that Scully has that, again, she's in danger. You know, it ties into, like, this ongoing thread that's gone through this entire season, actually, about her fear of you know, death and being close to death and all of this in various different ways. So it's a good beat that they at least play on that, which is very good. And, you know, poor Osborne, really, I feel sorry for the guy, you know, because he's pretty much condemned right from the very beginning, the first time we meet him. And he spends the rest of the episode knowing he's going to die, and then trying to help Scully as best he can.
Right. And, you know, you just think of sort of the perils of being on a dangerous frontier, which I know sounds weird. That sounds like it's the Old West or something. But you know, this is a frontier. This is like a dangerous frontier dealing with whatever contagion, pathogen, virus, whatever you want to say, that nobody understands. And, you know, that you hope that the people who inhabit that frontier, who are on that frontier, are people who do have that moral compass, they're high moral fiber, and they understand that even though, you know, they may die, that, you know, there are greater concerns there. And I mean, and that's really what he does in this episode. I mean, he doesn't want to be infected more than anybody else would want to be, but he even when he's sick, he's helping Scully.
Yeah, and he didn't have to. You know, he could have just not told her what she needs to know and just, you know, carry on the conspiracy, but he doesn't. So that is a nice, it's a nice little character for Charles Martin Smith to play, actually, because he's got a good arc that, goes throughout the episode. But this is where I have my headcanon connection to the Syndicate, because the other Doctor, who then tells Scully to get out as they're burning, they're incinerating the bodies, he is played by the same actor who later appears in several episodes as a Syndicate goon. Morris, I can't pronounce his surname, Panitch, I think his surname is. But he later appears as the grey-haired man in a bunch of mythology episodes in season 3 and season 4.
Wonderful. See, I mean, that's great. I think, yes. So you've got like a literal connection there. Yes. Oh, gosh, I didn't even put that together. I was watching this and I was thinking, what is going on here really, and why is this cigarette smoking man involved in this, and how is Pink Pharmaceuticals? And what I was thinking was that at this point the Syndicate must not have settled on bees as a delivery system.
Yeah.
And that so this, you know, this biodiversity project, whatever, in Costa Rica, you know, you're talking about this breeding process, and the larva, you know, travels by spores. So it's like a delivery process for the black oil virus, you know, that, let's say, it could be like the bees, you know, but I don't know. That's what I was thinking. I was like, it's another delivery system, and it's also insectoid, so insects, whatever the word would be. So
I think there's so much logic in that. I mean, to me, this is because by the end, you know, we know this was a test, like quite a lot of when the X-Files does episodes about bioweapons or viruses, like the Pine Bluff variant in season 5, that ends up being, which is another great episode, that ends up being a test, a government test, to test a bioweapon. And in this case, this is almost certainly the Syndicate testing this virus that isn't the black oil, but they're testing a method of delivery. Totally. I completely see that. I think that's that's why I think there are tethers to the mythology. And it makes me wonder if Chris Carter didn't have this in the back of his mind, you know, when he was writing the episode, if he hadn't already thought there was going to be a virus involved, which, you know, comes down the pipe a little bit later in the show, but not massively, not, you know, it's coming. The black oil is only about 20 episodes away. It's not a million miles away. So,
right.
You know, it makes me wonder if he hasn't got this at the back of his mind about a deadly virus, a contagion, you know, the Syndicate being behind it, which is a really big part of the mythology ultimately throughout the entire show. So I think you're on something there, John. Definitely.
You know, for me, it's just one of these things I love about the X-Files. And you know, the next time I get to talk to Chris Carter, say, yeah, how did you do this? You know,
yeah, do it.
You know, you go back and you watch some of the episodes before where we were really just picking up the pieces, and they just fit so well. I mean, I feel like what we talked about. You actually see somebody, an actor, who is consistent with the Syndicate. And what I'm saying is that, yeah, and as far as what their plan was, this is consistent. I think. I want to say, did you know? did you know, or was it just a happy circumstance? But you know, it just fascinates me to no end, and I can't tell if it's just that we, as dedicated, you know, followers, fans of the show, are able to tie together those threads, or are there those threads really dangling to be tied together? You know what I'm saying? I don't know.
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's the fact that we do look for connections that weren't explicitly there, but I think you can kind of connect dots up that maybe they weren't planned to be connected up. But if you go back and you link things based on characters, based on ideas, based on different points in the mythology, you can kind of, in your, as I say, your head canon, stitch things together. Yeah. So I like to think that this is definitely part of the bigger Syndicate plan. Absolutely. And having Smoking Man in there, for me, is a big, if he hadn't been involved, then
right,
it would be less so. But he's involved, you know, he knows what's going on. He's, you know, and we'll get to him in a bit. But like, there is that, you know, there is that there. And I'm still going, I mean, the grey-haired man, he isn't credited as that. He's Dr. Simon Auerbach, although, but you in this, but you never get that referenced. That's just his name in the credits. So for me, he could be one and the same. And I'm going with that.
No, I like that. I mean, you know, we've got these two strands now that just, you know,
yeah,
really fit. And like you said, the cigarette smoking, he's not in every single episode. So when he's there, you know, you have to assume he's working to his particular nefarious end, right?
Totally. Yeah.
You know, that he knows what he's working on, and that it's part of it's his agenda. And so why is he here if this isn't part of that agenda, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's like to reference Softlight again. which will be coming next week, but it's like Mr. X cropping up in that, you know, and actually being involved in the storyline of these experiments into, you know, the deadly shadow that Chester Banton has. And it's that whole thing of there is a tether there. There is a connection to the bigger, for whatever they're trying to do and whatever the experiments are about. And it's clearer with this episode than in that one as to why the Syndicate would be interested. But it's, yeah, I love that. It just does tether it a little bit more. So that's my theory there. But obviously,
I love it.
Yeah. Cheers. Yeah. I think we've both got good ones there. Good theories. The story now is, you know, rocketing along. The prisoners are out there. They're hurting people. They're infected. They're reuniting with Paul, the main bad guy, in inverted commas, although he's not really the bad guy. He's more just a victim in a way, although he's a nasty victim. Goes back to his family, and the marshals are hot on their tail. I think there's a great sequence where the marshals come to the gas station, and before Mulder's kicking through doors, where there's a sense of calm for like about 10 seconds, that the sound fades off, you get a few shots, and then suddenly trucks, guns, music just races in. I really like that. It's a nice touch in the direction.
Right. You know, and again, it just feels so cinematic. It feels like there's just this like total mastery of technique and as far as how this episode was constructed to sort of wring out the maximum emotional engagement and impact on the audience, you know, from the very grotesque special effects to the sound bridge you just described, you know, that it just works on this cinematic level. And, you know, when I was writing my book, Horror Films of the 90s, one of the things I said is, you know, because people say, well, why, you know, the 70s and 80s were great times for horror films and 90s were not so great, you know, and why is that? And, you know, I'm not trying to blame the X-Files, but every Friday night or Sunday night when the series moved, you got an hour of, you know, great horror movie, you know, free, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like, so you're going to go out, right? You're going to go out and see something that might not be as good, right? You know, and you know, especially, you know, I'm thinking like 95 to maybe 97, 98, right in that zone, and where, you know, this episode falls. I mean, I think that's certainly the case. It's like, you know, the X-Files, you know, maybe another reason that people don't immediately count this as such a great episode is that there are so many really successful X-Files episodes. And, you know, they hit it on a regular basis, so much so that it was rare when they missed. I mean, that's how I felt. Certainly for the first six seasons, I would make that assessment, that it was very rare that there was an off week, you know, that their batting average was really good. And so it's like, wow, this episode is so well made, so well put together. I mean, you could pad it out, which would hurt it a little bit. But if you padded this out to 75 minutes, you've got almost, it's like so many X-Files episodes. You've got a feature film here. You know, it's filmed so well. It's just filmed so well and put together so well.
It's so true. And I think that's absolutely right about the fact that the X-Files was delivering, you know, movie quality stuff every week. And yeah, this kind of episode, this is the point they're really starting to get a handle on that as well. Throughout season two, it's felt more cinematic. But as we get further on through the season, it builds and it builds and it builds, you know, and then you eventually build to like Anasazi and the season finale, and then that trilogy, which is the big, you know, that's the point where you go, this show is now huge. This show is now cinematic. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it's firing on all cylinders. And we're building towards that, really.
I find it stunning because, again, people, you know, today it's so easy to think of something that, you know, HBO makes, or, you know, Westworld, or something like Game of Thrones, or, you know, we're used to now sort of television looking really great and moving really great and being really put together like this. But, you know, a lot of people don't remember that, you know, that before the X-Files, TV was sort of like a box. It wasn't it wasn't cinematic like this. And, you know, for me, like, the X-Files signals like the beginning of cinematic television.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always said this. I've always thought this. This is why I try and, as nicely as I can, educate people who weren't around when it was on TV like we were, to say, if you want the origin of where most of these great shows come from, you go back to this and
absolutely
a few other shows around the same time. This is it. This is the touchstone of the reason we have this great TV these days. You know, because, I mean, I'm sure you may well agree, John. I think TV is in an amazing place right now. TV is where the great storytelling on the whole is taking place now.
Absolutely. It's eclipsed the movies by far. Movies and TV have switched places. You know, now it used to be that TV had to be so homogenized that we got, you know, crap that people remembered, like Gilligan's Island, but it was still crap, even if you're nostalgic about it. But it was so homogenized because it had to appeal to everybody. Now movies have to succeed, you know, on their opening weekend, and they've become homogenized. And TV has gotten to this thing where it can be niche, you know, and you can get something like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones. And, you know, the X-Files is the linchpin, you know, as I think we talked about when the writer's room in the X-Files is like, has spread like a virus across television for the good of television, you know, and, you know, those writers have now created their own shows. Those directors are still directing, you know, it's a golden age for television, but you look at what started that golden age. I don't know that you can pick a show other than the X-Files and say that's where it started. I mean, I don't know that another series that's had the impact of the X-Files in terms of writers and directors. I can't think of another series where.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to think of one, really, in terms of the sheer breadth and scope. Right. It's very true. It's very true. Another good example of the cinematic element is in this scene, and it, not just a cinematic element, but I think this moment really for me is one of those moments that exemplifies what the X-Files is. It's the bit where they're in the gas station, they're trying to figure out where the prisoners went, and suddenly this helicopter sweeps in, lands, guys in hazmat suits take the seemingly healthy gas station attendant, spirit him away. Mulder's going, "Who are you? Where'd you come from?" They don't say anything. They get in the chopper, they go, you never see that guy again. That, to me, that is the X-Files in a nutshell.
Yes. You know, that brings up such a strange anecdote, but just to show how influential the X-Files has been at that moment. Okay, so I watched this episode, you know, to prepare for our chat today to talk about this. And then I ended up watching this movie with my son, who's 10. It's a movie called Monster Trucks.
Oh, yeah.
Where there are these, like, monsters that come out of the ground, like, inhabit trucks. I mean, it's a crazy, silly kids movie. Very cute, but it's a kids movie. But there's a scene in that where it's like there's like a long shot, there's hills, there's like a scientific facility, and a helicopter comes down. And it's like it's like it just hit, like, it's like this is totally the X, this moment is just totally the X-Files, you know. It's just like you know that moment, don't you, where, you know, you were at some secret facility. We don't know what's going on. You know, a helicopter is landing. People who look suspicious get out. You know what I'm saying?
It's
You know, the X-Files, like, sort of defined that moment. And you see it again and again in movies. There was a movie I watched a couple years ago called Extraterrestrial where it had a moment like that. And it had a guy who was smoking. It was a total X-Files. You know? It's just like it's this moment where it's like, okay, here they come. We don't really know who they are. but here they are in their, you know, their helicopters, and they know what they're doing, but we don't know what they're doing. Yeah. And that's a perfect moment in this episode. Absolutely.
It's true. It's true. And it's that those kind of scenes are all over TV, movies, pop culture since this show, you know. And,
right.
And the thing is that even the X-Files got them from stories and got them from real life lore and all these things. But it was the first show to really popularize this idea of mysterious forces belonging to organizations you don't know, that are never clear, who just appear, do things, and then disappear into the shadows, you know, and it's terrifying.
And I wonder if that resonates not only from, like you said, what, you know, the sort of conspiracy theory zeitgeist of our culture, but also from, I know, Chris Carter's love of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the idea that, you know, that whole movie is about this quest and get the Ark, and at the end, the government says, okay, we'll take it from here, and, you know, wheels it into that warehouse, you know, and we've had those shots of the cigarette smoking man, that, you know, dropping things in the Pentagon, and, you know, it's like, is it like an outgrowth of that, you know? But that was like in the 30s, and so you wouldn't have like these modern helicopters or these containment units. It's like an updating of that idea that we saw there of, you know, we'll take it from here, don't worry yourself, don't try to figure it out either.
yeah because we're not, because we may not. And that's the thing, in Raiders, they, you know, they say, well, take it from here. You trust them that they're going to get to the bottom of it. And they put it in a box, they stick it in a warehouse, and they are never going to look at it again. And that,
right.
That's, exactly. but they're never going to tell anyone they've got this, you know, this vessel of ultimate power. It's going to sit there in a warehouse. And I like to think in my head, I like to think that warehouse, it's still there. like now, like nearly 100 years on, that the Ark of the Covenant is still there. And that's great. And I think you're right. I think the Smoking Man is a natural extension of that idea, definitely, with all, going into the Pentagon and putting these things away. And this kind of episode is a good episode that is all about them putting something out there that they're never going to tell the public about, you know, and that's a real core of the episode that we get to. As Scully is starting to understand the connection with Pink Pharmaceuticals and realizing there is a cover-up in progress here, this isn't just a random outbreak of a virus. This is something that has been specifically set up in order to test something or for an agenda. You get this really good scene where Mulder goes to Skinner's office, and this is a great confrontation with the Smoking Man. I think this is another really, really good one. And it's a really well-shot scene because at first Mulder goes there asking Skinner, why were we given this case? What's going on? There is a cover-up. And then Smoking Man is just in the corner in shadow.
There. Yeah.
And then you get this great little conversation between them that is all about the idea of truth versus control of the truth. And it crystallizes part of their relationship. It's less personal than some of their confrontations, but it crystallizes the ideologies, I think, between Mulder and the Smoking Man.
Right. And, you know, so much of this episode, you see so much of what Mulder is agonizing over, and it's thrown in his face by the convict's girlfriend, is this: when is it right to notify people, and when is it our responsibility not to notify people? And is that, you know, well, both of those are control. Right? Determining when, what you tell people, when you tell them, what you do tell them, and what you don't tell them. And, you know, and Mulder is really grappling with that. I wrote that down. You know, this episode is really about when do you inform the public about something and when do you not? And, you know, I was really trying to think about saying, well, you know, when do you tell them? When do you tell us? When do we need to know? And when is it better that we don't know? I mean, I was alive during the Reston crisis, and I didn't know about it. You know what I'm saying? I was in college at that point at University of Richmond. I did not know this was going on in Reston, Virginia. How would people have reacted in Richmond, in Washington, D.C., if they knew that there was this potentially deadly virus going on? So what is the responsibility of the government in a situation like that? When do you tell people? When do you not? And Mulder is truly, truly, I think, puzzled by this and doesn't know what the right thing to do is.
As I was watching it, I was thinking, like you were, what is the right decision? I mean, we know obviously the Smoking Man is, and his rationale is, you know, if we tell everyone what's going on, then, you know, we're not helping people. And he cites the 1988 outbreak of hemorrhagic fever. And he says, you know, controlling the information controlled the disease. And then Mulder says, you know, you can't protect the public by lying to them. And he says, it's done every day. And then Mulder says, well, I won't be a part of that. And this is it. It's that whole thing of, we know the Smoking Man is doing this partly out of controlling his own conspiracy and his own cover-up. But ultimately, is Mulder right? And I was left wondering, maybe he's not. And even Scully doesn't necessarily think he is as well, because you then get that following scene where Scully says to him, you know, I think Mulder says, what if someone dies because we didn't release what we knew? And then she says, what if someone dies because we did? You know, it might be the other way around. But it's that whole idea that Scully is saying, well, you know, if we tell everybody, we could cause more problems. And it's that whole idea of mass hysteria, isn't it? People, the moment you tell someone that there is a viral outbreak, we can't control it, we don't necessarily know how to cure it, it could be anywhere, people are going to go crazy. People are going to go nuts.
Exactly. You know, and I hate it, but I love that the X-Files will do this. I hate that it asks me to, in some sense, realize that the cigarette smoking man has a point, but maybe not for his reasons. But it's like, yeah, you know, I don't know if we've yet crossed that threshold where everybody needs to know that, or it's just going to panic people unnecessarily. People are going to get out on the highway and start driving like maniacs and killing each other in car accidents. You know what I'm saying? It's like, yeah. You know, that's one reason I love the X-Files so much, is that it's so nuanced and three-dimensional that you can say, you know, yeah, the cigarette smoking man probably has a point here, even though he's evil and I disagree with him on everything philosophically. But he may have a point. It might not be the right thing to do to tell the people right now.
It would end up like that scene in War of the Cockroaches where everyone finds out the killer roaches are around and they raid the store. They're all going, right. Roaches! And they just raid the store. It would be like that. It would be like yes. that. Just played less for laughs. But, but
exactly. And, yeah. you know, I find it so ironic. Mulder is such a tortured protagonist. So he's here arguing all along, you know, we need to tell people. People need to know. We can't hide the truth. We can't lie. And then he goes to interview the convict's girlfriend or, well, I guess his girlfriend. And she says, well, and she basically throws this in his face. She's like, why should I tell the truth if you're not telling the truth? And I'm like, oh, don't, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when you're throwing this in Mulder's face and he's on your side, you know, and it just makes him reexamine it again.
It raises really interesting questions about, like you say, truth, the control of truth, when is the right time to let people know about something, and is it done for the right reasons? And Mulder's motives are pure, you know, in this. Mulder's motives are he wants people to understand what's going on because there is a cover-up, there is a conspiracy, there are people actively, you know, working against the interests of the people. But at the same time, this isn't about exposing the truth about aliens. You know, if that's a very different thing. He could do that at any time, put it in a newspaper, everyone will go, wow. This is about actually saying there is a killer disease that our own government may have given you, and we can't cure it. We don't know where it is. That's very different. And I think that's what Scully has to turn around and make him aware of and say, from a scientist point of view, from a doctor point of view, this isn't as simple as just the, you know, your own way of looking at the truth and belief that the truth should be known. This is more complicated. This is about an actual what could happen to the world, what could happen to people if people know, and could it be for the worse? And Scully is looking at it from that rational scientific perspective, which is what she does all the time. She's the one who has to cool Mulder down all the time.
I think so too, and again, I don't want to make Mulder into in any way, shape or form a bad guy or the cigarette smoking man into a good guy, but I mean, what you have there are two agendas. Mulder wants the truth out there no matter what, and the cigarette smoking man does not. But you're right, Scully is there and she's like, you know, those are two like sort of extreme points of view that are part of your agendas or ideology or whatever. You know, this is about science. This is about how people behave. It's about psychology. We can't just make a decision based on ideology or agenda.
It has to be about more than that. It has to be about what is in the best interest of the public, what is in the best interest of the people. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's complicated because there are no clear answers with this one. While Mulder is right, he's also wrong. And while the smoking man is obviously evil and doing things, he does have a point. And if he was doing things for the right reasons, the smoking man would be right. The smoking man would be you'd be able to say, if we control the information, we can control the disease. But in this case, he's controlling the information because he's given the disease. You know, he's responsible, or his organization or whatever is responsible for this, ultimately, even if that's not explicitly said.
I just love that the X-Files is like this deep, because we at the end of the episode, we're not given any answers.
No.
We're not told what was right or what was wrong. We're not spoon-fed any information like, oh, Mulder was right all along. You know, we're not given any sort of platitude like, you always have to tell people. They are, or you can never tell. You know, it's unresolved. Like so much of the X-Files, they raise it, they debate it. You have to think about it, but they're not going to give you any answer or tell you or give you any guidance and say you know it's always this way or always that way.
There will be no truth.
That's right.
The truth is whatever you believe. But it's a good fundamental core of the episode, which then allows us to head towards the conclusion with some clear lines drawn. You know, you've got Scully on the one hand learning whether or not she's infected, and you get the sequence of the, you know, the insect being placed on her arm to actually infect her to test whether or not she's infected, or bite her to test whether or not she's infected, which is a really clever way, because as Osborne explains when he's talking about how he works for the company and things like that, he says they were looking for a dilating enzyme in the insect, apparently, but it carries the parasite, which attacks the immune system when the pustules expel larvae, which then repeats the process. So it's all about, you know, that's how it spreads. So Scully will be able to, if she's not infected, then that bite won't show anything. It's a good way of doing that, and it's a good moment that allows the two strands to come together when she basically turns around to Mulder and says, they've burned all the evidence. The only proof you're going to get that there was a conspiracy is the one prisoner who's left who you need to catch, which leads to that really great final sequence. I think all the stuff on the bus is really good.
Drives me crazy. Yeah. It is. But boy, talk about, you know, playing your audience like a piano and the suspense. I mean, you know, when you mentioned before, you know, we know Scully isn't going to get killed or, you know, die from this. And we know Mulder isn't either. But, you know, successful, whatever, artistry, you feel that, like, there is some sort of jeopardy. And I think that's why the child is there. You know, you think, oh my gosh, we saw a family. And again, this is where that family at the gas station with the RV plays in. We saw a family get destroyed earlier in the episode. So it's like, okay, now here's a kid. We already threw an innocent family at you and they got killed. Now here's this kid on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. There was a nice little beat, wasn't there, though, of character with the boy. I mean, I this is always something I noticed when I watched the episode. When you first see him, he's with his mom and he's desperate to get on the bus. And she says, oh, come and give me a hug, you know, before you go. And he's like, oh, fine, all right then. And then he gets on the bus and there's a little look on her face as if, like, she's sad that he doesn't really want to be with her or want to hug her and he just wants to get away from her. And I think it sets up the boy, obviously, who then is in jeopardy. But it's a lovely little character beat, I think. And it's another example of how they layer little things into this episode. They didn't need to do that. You could have just had the lad on the bus and have him grabbed. But when he eventually is grabbed by Paul, you're a little bit more invested in him because you've seen that little fleeting beat of characterization. And that's really well done.
Absolutely. It's like that moment was meant to sort of tweak this string, to sort of pluck this string for us emotionally that's then going to resonate when there's the hostage situation. You know, it's like, oh, we met his mom and his mom was uncertain about sending him and they had this sort of tender but not tender, you know, they had this sort of moment, this very human moment, and you felt basically the vulnerability of that relationship and the vulnerability of a child, and then just like spiked that, put it on steroids by having him be held hostage with that, you know, pulsating oil next to, you know, right next to him, you know,
yeah,
waiting for it to go, you know, waiting for it to pop right on him, you know, that's horrible.
Even though you'd know it was like a prop or whatever, as that boy, I'd be like, going, oh, I hate this thing. I want to get away from this guy.
Oh my gosh, the close shots of it, you know, just sort of throbbing there right next to him. And I thought, you know, that is just, you know, it's the X-Files at its most impactful and sort of, you know, I want to say manipulative, but I think that probably sounds like a negative connotation, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, that's what art is supposed to do. You know, art is supposed to create feelings in those who experience it. It's supposed to create emotions, you know, including anxiety, including suspense. I mean, and that's what it's doing. It's just like the X-Files at its most, like, ruthlessly efficient and impactful, you know what I mean? But it is artistic. I mean, you're right, it's done artfully, but boy, for me, maybe it's because I'm a dad, that really works on me, that I always come back to that. And I know it's worked on my wife and she felt that way, but since I've become a father, it's worked on me even more, like, oh my gosh, do not do this to this child.
Yeah, you know? It's because you at this point you really don't know whether or not they're gonna go there, you know. You think this kid could genuinely be killed. I think what the way Mulder deals with it though is really good. It's a really good Mulder moment where he gets on that bus and he just talks Paul around, basically, you know, and he gets him to release the boy and all the people to get off the bus. He does it really well, Mulder does. I think, you know, when you talked about Jeopardy earlier, I think one of the things about this episode, even though, yeah, you know that Mulder and Scully are going to be fine ultimately, that there's this sense all the way through that something more terrible could happen after this whole episode. That it's got this, as I said, doom. It's got this level of foreboding. All the way through, there is this idea that, and even Osborne says to Scully, don't think that this couldn't happen again. Don't think this is isolated. This will happen again. They will do something like this again. Even at the end, when Mulder's got the gun on Paul and he says, just tell me who sent you this and I'll make sure they don't get away with it. You just get this feeling that's not going to happen. That, you know, this is an inevitability. Whatever this virus is, it's going to come back, and that's terrifying. And you get that. I think you get that all the way through.
I think so too. And it's very interesting how the story is constructed. You struck on something that I think is very important: the amorphous dread of this episode. I mean, we never go to a boardroom in Pink Pharmaceuticals. We never actually see an order being executed or anything like that. So much of the action of this episode is outside the actual frame of the films. The people who decided to send it, the actual sending of the thing before it arrived, there are all of these pieces that we know must exist, but we actually don't know. We don't have anybody's face at Pink Pharmaceuticals to connect it to, other than, you know, Dr. Osborne pretending to be with the CDC. But, you know, he was a good guy. He wasn't the mastermind. You know, even the cigarette smoking man, he's sort of a Judas, a corrupt official in the midst of it. But he's not the one who made this decision. So we have this story and it's a puzzle and we see all these pieces, but there are a lot of pieces that are missing because we don't see them. And that creates this feeling, this almost oppressive feeling, as you said, of dread, of foreboding, this amorphous fear that we should be afraid of something, that someone we can't see and take their measure because we can't see them is acting on us, is acting against us, is acting in a way that could harm us. And that's a really hard story to do. It's like you sit down and you think, well, who's the villain of this story? Somebody we never see.
Yeah. Yeah.
someone whose motives we never really see played out. I mean, we assume it's for profit, right? Or it's part of the syndicate or whatever. But I mean, again, that we're making assumptions, right? We don't actually know. And I find that really fascinating, a fascinating part of this story, that so much of it takes place outside the confines of the frame, outside of what we actually see. And I think that's one reason it's so effective.
Yeah, definitely. There's a connection as well, I think, to the episode Blood earlier in the season two episode, not literally, but in thematically, in the idea that that was an episode that involved subliminal messages and people killing each other. It was that idea that you never knew who was behind that all the way through. And by the end, you still don't know. You still don't know who's done it, who's set all this up for whatever purpose. And it is that same level. You know it's got to be somebody on the inside. You know, that's the suggestion. That, and the X-Files does this quite a bit. F. Emasculata is a great example of, an agenda that you can't quite figure out that has these horrendous consequences and could happen again. It is a real fear. It is a really terrifying idea. And you know, on a basic fundamental level, you could imagine that Paul, the criminal, is the villain, but he's not at all. He's not a nice guy, and in many respects, he deserves what he gets at the end. But he is a victim as well. He's been set up with this.
He's a pawn.
He's a pawn in a bigger game, definitely. So it is hard to identify a villain, and that's difficult, and that's why this episode raises lots of different ideas and different questions. And then by the end, when he gets shot, you get, I don't know, I always think, whenever I see that, I always think, was that just coincidence? Or, you know, because it seems a very convenient time for him to be shot in the head as he's about potentially to tell Mulder what he needs to know. Again, it's that level of, are they watching? Who's in control? Right. Is this part of the big game?
Well, you know, what orders are people really, the man who pulled the trigger, what orders are he really operating under? What is the underlying idea here? Is it to end a hostage situation? Is it to make sure that the plan is not in jeopardy? All these things just sort of floating around out there, and it creates that amorphous dread. And the X-Files is terrific at doing that. I would hate to have to write a story that way, though, where it's like, you know, How do you write a story like that? It's like, okay, so this person is creating all of this, but you're never going to see that person. That person's never going to have a name or a face. All you're going to see is the consequences of an action, but we don't know when it took place. You know what I'm saying? It's like, wow, just imagine like putting together this story like this. And you see the artistry and you see how successful it is, because that would not be an easy story to put together like this. I mean, at some point you have to say, you know, yeah, okay, so it was a board member at Pink Pharmaceutical working with the syndicate, if we're going to pull that in, but maybe it's not connected. But okay, and they want to get this to market and make money. Okay, but then you're never going to see them. You're never going to see their lifestyle. You're never going to know why they made that decision. You're never going to know how they're entangled with law enforcement. You're never going to know if they are actually entangled with law enforcement, or they just have this one guy in the FBI who – maybe he's on their board or something. You know what I'm saying? It's like, It's really amazing to me the sort of levels of complexity here, and that so much is missing. So much is missing, and in that missing aspect, we fill in all these ideas.
So much is missing that could have been filled in outside of the episode. You know, like you said, it could have been that a lot of this was worked out by Chris Carter and Howard Gordon, but they know right. They're never going to put it in there. They know, but yeah. they're never going to tell us, and they're going to leave us wondering. So by the time you get to that final scene where Mulder realizes that it was all they were involved in the case, so they could be discredited if the truth ever came out that they were pawns as well in the game, that you realize that there is a higher level of stuff going on here. There are people, there are wheels within wheels, there is a complexity, there is a, you know, an overarching game being played, which you don't really see, and that's what's really good. And that's why I like the part Skinner plays throughout this, because he's not in much of it, but in the two scenes he's in, it's the scene with the smoking man where he doesn't really say anything, and there's that great moment when Mulder says, "I won't be a party to this," and he says to Skinner, "What about you?" And Skinner doesn't answer because he is a part of it, but he doesn't. He's caught in the middle. And then at the final scene, he says, "You know," Mulder actually says to him, "Well, where do you stand on all this? Because this is a cover up." And he says, "I stand on the line that you keep crossing," which is a great line. And it's a great moment. And then, of course, he warns him. He says, "Watch your back. This is just the beginning." To me, this episode, in a way, I think it functions in a similar way that Tombs did. At the end of season one, in that Tombs wasn't connected to the mythology, it wasn't connected to the season finale or anything, but it set up things that then played out in the Erlenmeyer flask in a different way. It set up the smoking man, it set up Skinner, that they were potentially, you know, looking at shutting down the X-Files, and then Mulder at the end says this ominous feeling that I think things are going to change.
Right.
And I think this does a similar thing in that it suggests, you know, Skinner says this is just the beginning, there is something far deadlier, far bigger, far worse coming. And you've got to be prepared for it. And that's Anasazi, really. That's the big three-part episode that changes Mulder and Scully's lives forever, really.
No, you have an excellent point. I mean, I think that's right. You know, and again, you know, just to put a historical context on this, where television was in the 90s, you know, TV was not doing arcs. I mean, you know, and a lot of people have said that. And what you see here is that in a non-arc episode, there are still arc elements. You know, and I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and you know then Star Trek was amazing for its time in the 60s, and they would occasionally, you know, they would mention, well, we encountered the Romulans or the Neutrals, are, you know, they do a call out to a previous episode, but it's like, no, you could watch maybe those in any order, you know what I'm saying, and not really miss anything because they were so standalone, and that's great, no problem with that. But with the X-Files, it's like, no, you can see that even in the episodes that were not intentionally building towards that, they were still putting these things in so you can see the pieces of how it all fits together, which to me is really stunning.
Yeah, definitely. And this is a great example of it, because it doesn't link to Anasazi at all in terms of story, but it does link in the sense of building that idea, building right. that sense of threat, building that sense that Mulder and Scully are getting closer to things that are potentially going to destroy them. They're getting closer to conspiracy. They're getting closer to truth. And it's amping that up even more. And I think it does a really good job in that level of foreboding that we've talked about all the way through.
Things are coming to a fever pitch. You know what I mean? It's like it's like a snowball. You know, it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And even though you could like take this episode out, like if you were just watching the Myth Arc episodes, you'd still be missing the buildup, like you said. You know what I'm saying? It's like, say, well, that one doesn't really apply. It's not about the black oil. It's not really about, you know, purity control or whatever. You know, it's not really about the Erlenmeyer flesh, but it is still part of the chronology for Mulder and Scully leading up to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, Softlight does the same thing in a way, because it changes the relationship between Mulder and X, and that has a knock-on effect in the mythology episodes. So it's these episodes building towards something else, building towards something bigger. Did you catch your pun that you made unintentionally there, John, as well, when you said fever pitch? Nice.
Right. you're the one doing all the virus jokes.
That's right. True. That's true. It's spreading. The jokes are spreading. Oh, here we go. I'll stop now.
All right, Paul, what was in that package? Paul, what was in that package? A pharmaceutical company was using you as a guinea pig. If
You tell me what was in that package, I'll make sure they don't get away with it. Come on, Paul, you remember. Tell me!
So I'm sparing John a quiz, as I told him beforehand, because he suffered one already, and that's enough, I think. So, that's where we're going to bring the episode to an end. So we hope you've enjoyed our chat about Effemasculata, and it's just been a real joy to have you back on the show, John. It really has. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Well, thank you, Tony. I love spending this time with you. You're just awesome, and this is an awesome venue to think more about the X-Files, and it's because of you. Thank you.
Oh, you're too kind. You really are. Thank you very much. You're going to be back again, I really hope, at some point. But until then, where can people find you on online and what you're up to?
Right. Well, I blog every day at Reflections on Film and Television. And if you can't find the URL, just plug in John Kenneth Muir on a Google search, and it'll come up with my Twitter, and I'm on Facebook, and I have a website that I haven't updated in probably 10 years, but there is a link to my blog there. You can find my books on Amazon. You know, seek me out. I'm still talking about X-Files, very much excited about the opportunity to blog season 11 now that I know Woo! It's down the pike. Yeah, not wait.
Yeah, super excited. Super yes. excited.
I've been waiting. I checked, like, I Google search X-Files like every day, and when I saw that they said it's coming 10 episodes, I was over the moon.
I think the internet just melted at that point, I think. Brilliant. Check out John's blog and his books, guys. It's a font of amazing writing and great knowledge. So do look it up. It's really, really good stuff. And as I said before, you can look us up on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook with our Facebook page, The X-Cast, and our group. Do get involved in our group, guys. It's great. There's lots going on. The X-Cast podcast fan group. And if you really must look me up, I'm at Black Hole Media on Twitter, where I've got an assortment of different things going on. So, look us up. We're going to be back soon for a brand new episode. We're racing towards the end of season 2 now. And, we've still got some good episodes coming down the pipe. So, once more, a big thanks, John, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you, Tony. I can't wait to come back.
Awesome, awesome stuff. Remember, guys, until we see you next time, these immortal words... What's the truth, Agent Mulder? The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at @IamWillAye.
I'm saying this as a friend. Watch your back. This is just the beginning.